Electra Morales versus Lurk. And John Rebecca will appear first representing Ms. Morales.
Good morning, Your Honors. Yeah, my name is John Becker, and I represent Electra Morales. The basic facts of this case are really undisputed, and those basic facts are: this is a workers' comp claim where Ms. Morales sustained an unscheduled back injury. This was in 1991. She was given restrictions and returned to work. She was given a job of taping some motors, and she developed a carpal tunnel injury, so she developed a wrist, a scheduled injury. This was in 1994. Again, that injury was conceded to be work-related. There was no dispute about that. And additional restrictions were imposed at that time on the use primarily of her right hand. When she came back after being released by the doctor, the company said they had no work to fit her restrictions. And both parties agreed that she was unable to do any of the work at Amatec. Both vocational experts who appeared in this case indicated that Ms. Morales was permanently and totally disabled from a vocational standpoint. Only one of the vocational experts addressed the disability as it related to her back alone, and that expert said that if she had to go out on the job market now with only the back restrictions, her disability would have been 60%. So what it breaks down into, I see it, is two main issues. Can Ms. Morales recover the 60% loss of earning capacity as a result of the back injury when the reason for her termination was, at least in part, the subsequent scheduled injury? And actually, that breaks down to two sub-issues, because the Court of Appeals said if the back injury was a factor in her termination, she would have been able to recover loss of earning capacity. And the Court of Appeals said that in this case, they read it to be that the termination was due solely to the wrist injury, and therefore, since the back was not a factor, she could not recover loss of earning capacity. So, really, you have two sub-issues. The first one, the plaintiff's position, is that it doesn't matter what the termination was for. She's now been terminated, and under 102.44.6b, she is no longer working there, and she's entitled to bring a claim for loss of earning capacity, at least to the extent of 60%. A second issue,
under
which...
what statutory provision?
Pardon me?
Under what statutory provision?
102.44, sub 6, sub b.
Is that regardless of how she was, you say there's no dispute in the facts, but I gather, as I read the briefs, there seems to be a minor dispute as far as what she was terminated for, whether she could continue to work. And as I understand from the record and reading from the supervisor, Sophie Clays, that it was solely for the wrist restrictions. It had nothing to do with the back. Do you accept that?
No, I don't.
So there is a dispute, factually.
There is a dispute on that regard, but if I can explain that for 1 minute. The facts I cited earlier are the basic facts that I think set forth the issues. I don't think it matters why she was terminated, but if it does, there is evidence both ways. Sophie Clay says that they wouldn't have been able to accommodate her even if she didn't have the back injury. Morella says if she had only the wrist injury, there were jobs there she could do. But the ALJ never made a finding of fact as to whether she was terminated just for the hand injury. The ALJ mistakenly said the parties have agreed that the reason she can't work is only due to the wrist injury, and that is not true. And I cited to the record, the transcript, where what the parties agreed to was that because of both injuries, she was no longer able to continue working. So there's never been a finding of fact that the wrist injury was the sole reason for her termination.
And I don't want to take issue, but I couldn't find, you're saying the parties, your client and Amatec Electric agreed that it was for both. I didn't find that in the record.
What's your citation?
Yeah, that's what I'm asking.
That the parties had agreed she could no longer work? It's in the appendix.
Just what page?
Page 4. Page E2, I'm sorry.
Say that again, please.
Appendix page E2. This is from the transcript of the hearing, and it's the second full sentence, third full sentence. This is the judge, the ALJ, speaking at that time. And he said, the reason this later injury is material is that there's an allegation that the restrictions on her back plus the restrictions on her hand now makes her reemployment at the employer impossible and may have a significant loss of earning capacity. So,
but that's an allegation. But that's an allegation. It's not. That's what I'm asking.
Well, there was never any agreement. But there was never any agreement by the parties that
right.
the hand injury was the sole.
And just so I understand, there is the testimony of your client, and there is the testimony of the supervisor Clay as to what each thought. Correct.
Correct.
All right.
Let me make sure I understand. What your premise is, as I understand it, is the ALJ, in his opinion, said the parties concede that she was could not return to work because of her wrist injury. And you're saying that is an erroneous finding because what you're referencing on E2 is the applicant's, plaintiff's position. And that position does not reflect the concession of just the wrist injury, but a combination.
Correct.
Is that what I understand you're saying? That's what your point is?
Correct.
But what was the ALJ finding? Did he make a finding that the termination is because of the syndrome, the tunnel syndrome?
The ALJ never made a specific finding as to the cause of her termination. The only thing he said was that the parties had agreed that the reason she couldn't return to work was because of her wrist injury, and that was not accurate. It was following the wrist injury.
In other words, on C3, you're saying, of C3 being in the appendix, both parties concede that the reason her return to work at respondent was impossible is due to the restrictions of her hand. That's what you're referring to as erroneous. Is that correct?
Yes. So that is the only, what would be considered a finding, but it's not really a finding. He's just saying this is what the parties agreed to. He never analyzed the facts to make that finding. He said the parties have agreed to this. The parties did agree it was after the wrist injury that she became unable to work, but she wasn't unable to work solely because of the wrist injury. Again, the ALJ never made a finding in that regard, nor did the LIRC. As a matter of fact, the ALJ and the LIRC, well, the ALJ specifically said she was terminated. So when you look at the statute, 102.44 sub 6 sub B, which you'll have to look at, you start out with 102.44 sub 3, which is the statute on unscheduled injuries. And then it says if the disability is not covered in the schedules, then you can make a claim for loss of earning capacity. Sub 6A then limits that right. Sub 6A says, but you can't recover loss of earning capacity if you return to your former employer and you're making at least 15%. Then sub B, so that goes further, it says, but if certain conditions occur, then you still can come back and bring your claim at a later date. And those three conditions are set forth in 102.44(6)(b). And they're not numbered in sub B, but I label them as 1, 2, and 3. The first one is if the employment is terminated by the employer within the period set forth in 102.17(4), which is the 12-year statute of limitations. So under sub 6B, it says that if the employment is terminated by the employer within 12 years, the employee would have the right to come back and bring a claim for loss of earning capacity.
Let me ask you, in your interpretation, then, is that for that injury? It says that injury.
Not at all. That would be for any reason whatsoever. And I think Mr. Feldman would agree that if in 1994, Ametek closed down or laid her off, she could come back and bring a loss of earning capacity claim at that time. That the termination of employment does not have to be from the unscheduled injury. There's certainly nothing in the first section that suggests it even be related to any type of injury. Then we have the second provision in sub B, which is that the employee, because of his or her physical or mental limitations, prevent her from continuing in such employment, that the employee terminate the employment. And again, we have that situation here. It's one of those cases where both parties agree. Both 1 and 2 apply. And actually, I mean, the third one is if there's a 15% or more wage loss during the 12-year period. And again, those provisions are connected by the word or. So if any one of those three apply, she would have the right to come back and bring a claim for loss of earning capacity.
So just so I understand, it's your position that because she had an unscheduled injury, that if she were terminated within, what is it, a 12-year period?
12 years.
That she would be entitled to this loss of earning?
Yes.
Regardless of why she was terminated?
Yes.
Whether it's because syndrome or a plant closed down or anything else?
Yes.
That's your position?
Yes.
And then I would assume that your position is that if she were terminated because of both an unscheduled and scheduled injury, she would be entitled to loss of earnings.
Yes.
So if that's your, if you should prevail on the first, your first position, and we'll of course question opposing counsel on that, she should prevail on the first question. It's irrelevant about the factual issue.
Correct.
Okay. Because I was looking again at the Court of Appeals decision in which Judge Brown, writing for the court, says the ALJ stated, just as you did, both parties conceived that the reason her return to work was impossible was because of her hand. They also recognize your brief that there was an issue of fact about that. Then they say the record supports the conclusion it was the wrist, not the back restriction. So that, do you consider that a finding of fact by the Court of Appeals?
Correct. I think they read the ALJ's decision as a finding of fact. There's no question there was evidence both sides, but I think when you look at the ALJ's decision, he did not weigh that evidence and did not make a finding of fact, and the Court of Appeals did interpret it as a finding of fact. So that's my position on that. Again, I don't know that we need to get to that. If my position is correct, that it doesn't matter why she was terminated. If we do, or if we get to that issue, then I still don't think there's been a finding of fact made. It would need to be remanded for that purpose.
Well, how do we handle that? Do we have to send that back to the administrative agency?
If we get to that issue, then we would need to send it back to the department for determination as to the cause of her termination.
Counsel, walk me through again the 102.44.6, your interpretation of that statute as to why the reason is irrelevant. And by that I mean, what lines, what words are you relying on for receipt of compensation in this case?
Okay. Again, we've got three different subsections, really, in B. And do you want me to address them all, or one?
Well, it seems like you're only hanging your hat on 1 and 2. Is that correct?
Well, actually, I think all three apply in this case.
You didn't mention 3, and I was interested in why you didn't. But walk me through what you are claiming entitles you to compensation, which will illustrate why the reason for termination is relevant, okay? So give me the words in the statute that you're relying on.
Why the reason for termination is irrelevant?
Yes.
Because it doesn't say, it just says if the employment relation is terminated by the employer.
Okay, now hold it. When you say it says, where are you referring? What are you referring
sub to? Sub 6, sub B. Says if during the period set forth in 102.17.4, that's the 12-year statute of limitations. So if within 12 years the employment relationship is terminated by the employer.
Just at the time of the injury.
Right. That's kind of inconsistent, or at least we read it as inconsistent, but Mr. Feldman shed the light on that for me yesterday, and we both looked at it, and it seemed to be inconsistent. But if you go up to 6A, it says where an injured employee is claiming compensation for disability under sub 2 or sub 3, has returned to work for the employer for whom he or she worked at the time of injury. And looking at sub B, the only way that makes sense is if at the time of injury refers to the employer. So if you're still working for the employer you worked at the time of injury and you are terminated within 12 years, otherwise it would make no sense. And that doesn't make sense. So under the first section of sub B, it says that during the 12-year period you are terminated, the employment relationship is terminated by the employer. It doesn't say it has to be for any particular reason. And again, I'm sure Mr. Feldman would concede, because it happens a lot where companies close down. I mean, in our area, Chrysler closed down a while back. People who had back injuries would then come in and bring loss of earning capacity claims. The right to do that has never been disputed. And the statutes don't say that there has to be any particular reason. If the employer terminates the relationship, it says you have the right to come back and get it. Now, yesterday...
Keep on.
Okay. Then, with the second section?
Yes.
Okay. And again, there it says, if the employment relationship is terminated by the employee because his or her physical or mental limitations prevent her from continuing in such employment. Again, that has happened here.
And it's not limited to the injury on the job.
Not at all. It doesn't say
something else.
It doesn't say it has to be because of the unscheduled injury. I mean, again, it could be, as I mentioned in my brief, it could be a non-work-related injury. She still is physically unable to compete in the job, to do this work, so she has to terminate her employment. And she now would have to compete in the open job market, not only with the disability from the schedule or even non-work-related injury, but also she has to compete with the unscheduled injury.
Counsel, I don't understand that one. That is, if the employment relationship is terminated, is it by the employee? And that doesn't appear to be the situation in this case. Am I misreading that?
It doesn't, which is why the Court of Appeals decision, I guess, is a little more confusing, because they seem to apply that section.
That does not apply, right?
No.
I think both apply. In some cases, one or the other will apply.
Give it to us straight.
Okay.
Did she terminate her employment?
In my petition for review, I cited a case as an analogy, which may not be a good analogy, but I'll try it again. Brown versus Thomas. It was an engagement ring case. And the...
Sounds analogous.
Yeah, that's right. I bet there's an easier answer to my question.
Well, let me try. The guy sued to get his ring back. And before that, the law in some states was if he broke off the engagement, she'd get to keep it. Or if she broke off the engagement, he got to keep it. Or it was real confusing. And the Court of Appeals said it doesn't matter. This is an engagement or a marriage that should not take place. And it's a matter of semantics. It doesn't really matter who calls it off. Well, it's the same thing here. Both parties agreed that she could not do any of the work there. So, the judge, the ALJ, made a finding that she was terminated, but she also knew she couldn't do the job and would have had to terminate her employment. Again, both sections apply here. Again, there are going to be some cases where one will apply and not the other, but here they both apply.
Did the ALJ make a finding that she was terminated by the employer? I don't see that. It seems a bit equivocal. But maybe I'm not looking at the right place.
C3.
That's what I'm looking at.
In the first full paragraph, second sentence from the bottom, it says, these restrictions meant respondent had no other work available to her, and she was terminated after her sick leave expired after 1 year.
Okay, so would you agree that that is tantamount to a finding by the ALJ that she was terminated by her employer?
I would agree with that.
Okay. And so if you agree to that, then you are not really, I'm just trying to find out, you're not pursuing under the second phrase of sub B, or by the employee, because you're not contesting the finding that she was terminated by employer.
Correct.
Okay. So what else are you pursuing?
Well, if you, again, and this is, I don't mean to confuse things, but the LIRC opinion, which again is not a was not findings of fact, but was in their opinion, in two situations, in two spots, they say she was terminated, and in another spot, they say she terminated her employment. So I'll deal with any three of the sections you want me to deal with. I think there is some confusion.
I think everybody agreed in, from the record, even Judge Merrick, the learned trial judge from Racine County, agreed that she was terminated. I mean, that was in his findings of fact also.
I believe based upon the ALJ's findings, which were adopted by
the commission. Which we don't look at, of course. We look at the ALJ and we look at the LRC.
Right, but the LIRC did adopt in full the findings of the ALJ, so it becomes, in essence, their finding. I'd like to move on to my second issue briefly. I have 5 minutes left, and I'd like to move on to the second issue as to whether or not, in a situation like this, an applicant can recover permanent total disability from a combination of the injuries. And again, the workers' compensation statutes are statutory. So again, the starting point is to look at the statutes. And the starting point is 102.44 sub 2, which states in the case of permanent total disability, the aggregate, they should be paid for the rest of their life. Okay. Sub 3 talks about permanent partial disability not covered under the schedules. But again, that's partial disability. The schedules, 102.52, deals with partial disabilities. Sub 2 specifically states some injuries, which will basically, as I read it, creates a conclusive presumption of permanent total disability. But it states in other cases, the department shall find the facts. Clearly, the cases where they've indicated a permanent total disability will exist are scheduled injuries or a combination of scheduled injuries. In Langus, the court indicated that there may be situations when a combination of scheduled and unscheduled injuries can give rise to a claim for permanent total disability. And in this case, we have both vocational experts indicating that she's permanently totally disabled. So under sub 2, again, the department never made a finding on that. It would need to be remanded as to whether she's permanently totally disabled for that finding of fact. But under sub 2, the department has the right to, even when a scheduled injury is involved, to make a finding of permanent total disability. So on the permanent total disability claim, there's the cases that talk about apportioning disability, Vandy, Zandy, and Mendikoff. In both of those cases, there was no permanent total disability. In Mendikoff, they found that she was 90% disabled at the hip and 5% at the ankle, but she was not permanently totally disabled. In Vandy Zandy, they had a combination of scheduled and unscheduled injuries, but there was not a claim for permanent total disability. But when the claims together rise to permanent total under 102.44 sub 2, I believe the department has the authority to make a finding of permanent total disability. So my time is almost up. Yeah.
In any case, you would indicate that we should send this back for remand?
Yes. I believe it should be sent back for remand. Again, depending on the court's opinion, if we're correct on the first issue that the reason for termination doesn't matter, then we don't have to worry about a finding fact as to why she's terminated. Then we would need a finding of fact by the department as to the extent of her disability. But what we need from this court is whether she is limited in her claim to 60% or the amount attributable only to the back, or whether she can present a claim for both permanent or permanent total based upon a combination of the injuries.
So we don't need a remand if what?
We need a remand no matter what.
No matter what. Okay.
Right.
Let me ask, since we've got a few moments, you made reference to Judge Merrick's opinion. He says in his opinion, there's nothing in the record before this court to establish that the commission has had any experience in interpreting the applicability of 102.44.6b in multiple injury situations as presented by the facts of this case. Is that correct in your opinion?
Yes.
He goes on to say, in addition, the reasoning set forth by both the ALJ and the commission implies that they were interpreting the language vis-a-vis these facts as a question of first impression. Is that also correct?
Yes.
Finally, he says, it may be noted that there is no published case law to suggest that the commission has previously interpreted this language. Is there any case that you can point to?
None that I'm aware of. You know, the Court of Appeals said, well, the courts have addressed this, and Vandy's Andy and Mendikoff, and they say you have to allocate the injuries to the allocate the percentages to the different injuries. But we didn't. That's not the issue. I mean, 10244 is 2 pages long. The fact that they've interpreted some sections of that statute doesn't mean they've addressed sub 6, sub B, which there are no cases addressing that section.
Counsel, your client got 3% at the wrist. Is that correct?
That's correct.
How much is 3% at the wrist?
About $1,500.
How much would 60% permanent total disability be in this case?
60%?
Do you know?
It would be about $90,000 paid over a period of time.
And then 100% permanent total disability is?
Her rate would be $233 a week.
For the rest of her life?
Yes.
And she got $1,500 for her wrist?
Yes. Okay, my time is up. So.
Thank you, Counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Douglas and Feldman, representing Amatec Lamb Electric and National Union Fire.
So may it please the Court, Chief Justice. Justices, I'm Doug Feldman from Linder Marzak, representing the respondents in this matter. The central issue in this case, which I think that the Court sees what that issue is because of the questioning, is the interpretation of Section 102446B. And that statutory section sets forth 3 specific events that if one of those 3 events occur after an employee has returned to work, that will entitle the employee to bring a claim for loss of earning capacity. I'm going to get right to the point. The statute is ugly. Many workers' compensation statutes are. It's kind of unwieldy, but there is a way to interpret this statute. There's a logical and rational way to interpret it, which allows for the continued even administration of the Workers' Compensation Act, and which gives each scenario, there's 3 scenarios in there, gives each one meaning. And contrary to the arguments from Mr. Becker, the legislature put ORs in there because there are 3 separate scenarios. You don't qualify under 2 or 3 scenarios. The situations have to follow under each one. And there's a common thread to how to interpret this statute, and this is, in practicality, how the Labor and Industry Review Commission has interpreted it throughout the years when they are hearing claims for loss of earning capacity. Interestingly, the Labor and Industry Review Commission and the Court of Appeals, they really just considered this a scenario 2 situation where the employment relationship was terminated by the employee because his or her physical or mental limitations. They didn't, neither LERC nor the Court of Appeals addressed scenario 1 or scenario 3, but there's a great way to interpret all 3, and it's as follows.
When I looked at the circuit court, which is in the appendix, Judge Merrick found problems about that. He said that they were all over the map.
They were all over the map.
And I'm looking at B, page 7. But it doesn't matter. I mean, we agree that that's what he said. He said ALJ did this, the LERC did that, and when he reads it.
That's absolutely correct, Chief Justice. LERC adopted the findings of the ALJ. The ALJ had language in there which said the employer terminated it. However, in the memorandum opinion of the Labor and Industry Review Commission, they say the employee terminated. The fact of the matter is I agree that it is irrelevant who terminated the relationship. When the legislature enacted scenario B by the employee because of his or her physical or mental limitations, I believe it was their contemplation that if an employee cannot perform available work at a company because of restrictions from an unscheduled injury, that that is tantamount to the employee terminating the job.
But you don't read that to mean you have a back injury, but later you get another ailment, Parkinson's, totally unrelated to the work, and then you leave because of your physical or mental limitations, which is Parkinson's, although you have had a back injury. You don't think that's covered under that section there?
Absolutely not.
That's really the issue.
That really is the issue. And, you know, the issue of whether or not the phrase physical or mental limitations, that has to refer to the physical or mental limitations caused by the unscheduled injury. You have to remember that we're in this section to begin with because we have an unscheduled injury. And as the Court of Appeals found, I mean, I can't believe the legislature would have been so envisioned to think of a situation where you're in the statute because of an unscheduled injury, and then you have some other scheduled injury down the line.
Well, but look, here, before I ask that question, what about the first aspect? The employment relationship is terminated by the employer at the time of the injury. What does that language mean?
The phrase at the time of injury does not refer to when the termination occurs.
It refers to the employer.
Right. The employer for whom the employee was working with at the time of injury. Okay, and it's not phrased well, but that has to be what it means. And the identical language is found in 6A, where they say if you return to work for the employer at the time of the injury. And I think it's clear that that's what that intends. And we are not advocating that if an employer terminates an employee for reasons unrelated to the work-related injury, that they are barred to bring a loss of earning capacity claim. The first scenario, which says if you're terminated by the employer, will allow a loss of earning capacity claim to be maintained if that termination is unrelated to the injury. An example is Ms. Morales comes back to work and with her unscheduled injury, and there's a plant shutdown, and everybody's laid off. That termination is unrelated to the injury, but she is now thrown into the labor market and has to work with those unscheduled restrictions. And
Counsel, where do you get all that extra language?
Which extra language,
well,
Justice?
You're referring, I think the plant terminated, the plant shut down.
I think you're talking about the first phrase now. Is that correct?
That's correct. If
so says, if during the 12 years the employment relationship is terminated by the employer, and we've agreed with at the time of an injury means, so it's terminated by the employer. That's what it says.
That's correct.
So if the plant shut down, your position is she'd get the loss of earnings.
That's correct. She was terminated by the employer, she gets loss of earnings. If there was a reduction in force and she was laid off with 50 people, she would get the loss of earnings because the employer cannot accommodate the restrictions from the unscheduled injury at that point in time.
Well, suppose that she's terminated because she's got this carpal tunnel syndrome, so and the employer can't accommodate her. Why should she suffer whether she's terminated for diabetes, Parkinson's, rather than the plant shutdown?
Because
it seems to me she's gone. And the whole point of this, which includes the second aspect of it, is that she's got this unscheduled injury. And that stays with her. And it's going to affect how she gets another job.
Because under that situation, Chief Justice, that's outside of the employer's control. The common theme in interpreting all three of these sections is that if the plant shuts down, that's outside of the employee's control. It's a circumstance not that the employee did not create. In Section 2, where it says by the employee because of her physical or mental limitations, that's a situation where the employee, unfortunately, not that she chose to do so, brings these additional restrictions, but there's still a job available for her at the plant. Under the scenario of Ms. Morales, we still have a job available within the unscheduled restrictions, but she cannot do it, so she falls within two, scenario two. However, under scenario two, limitations have to be because of the injury. So the thread that you have to look at is not who terminated who, but whether or not the termination was, in essence, created by the employer's inability to provide the work or the employee's inability to perform the work.
Well, why can't you say here the employer couldn't provide work? It couldn't provide work because you had, they had no work for somebody who had carpal tunnel syndrome, plus a limitation of only lifting 2 pounds. If she didn't have the back injury, she could have gone back to her first job.
But,
I mean, because carpal tunnel syndrome would not necessarily have affected her first job.
It would have, Chief Justice. I think the record is clear that the reason why there was no work available plant-wide was because of the restrictions on her back, and the transcript clearly shows testimony.
Back?
Excuse me, because of her wrist.
Okay.
And the transcript shows that if she didn't have the restrictions on her back, and only had the restrictions on her wrist, she still would not have had any work available to her in the plant. So what you need to look at is what, in scenario two, it contemplates a situation where the plant is still there and they have work available, but because of the unscheduled restrictions, the job cannot be performed by the employee. The employee has, in essence, terminated.
But if she did not have problems with her back, wouldn't she have remained at her other job and therefore not developed carpal tunnel?
Justice, that is an argument that was addressed by Attorney Becker. It's the causal connection argument, so forth, the but-for argument, which was addressed, I thought, very well by the Court of Appeals. With all due respect, just because you wake up in the morning and later get hit by a train doesn't mean that the reason why you got hit by the train was because you woke up in the morning. There have been no cases where that causal connection has been found. There are many cases under the Workers' Compensation Act where there are multiple injuries arising out of a initial injury. They're typically called compensable re-injuries. When you injure your knee and then later you're outside of work and you're going to downstairs to get a jar of pickles for your wife and your knee gives out and you fall down the stairs and hurt your back, the causal connection has been proven at that point in time, and there are many published in cases, the case from Lurkin, that causal connection is there. But in this case, it's simply too remote, and there's no proximal cause. This woman returned to work for an extended period of time in a different position. She sustained a carpal tunnel syndrome, and no different than somebody else who was put in that job previously. It was treated as a separate, distinct date of injury, and I don't think that you can make that causal connection test.
Counsel, I need help on this, and I'm still dangling on the plant closing, because obviously there's no plant closing language in here. This is what I need help with. The first phrase, first of all, 6A says you have an unscheduled injury. So you're starting with an unscheduled injury, and then the person returns to work, and they're making at least 85% of what they normally make. Okay, so that's set up in 6A. Then you get to 6B, and 6B has three provisions, and the first says, if within 12 years the employee is terminated by the employer. It says, if during the period set forth, etc., the employment relationship is terminated by the employer. Doesn't say because of the plant closing, doesn't say because of another injury, doesn't say because of an extended vacation or bad attitude or married the wrong person, doesn't say anything. Why should we fill in some more words there?
Justice, if you chose to interpret in that manner, it would indeed make the other two provisions, the termination by the employee and the 15% rule, superfluous.
Well, I'm not sure. The first one says, terminated by the employer, period. No reason. The second one says, terminated by the employee. Boy, that doesn't seem superfluous to me. That seems like a different situation. The third one says, but if during the course of the 12 years, the person did sustain more than the 15%, because 6A said, not 15%, then you get it. Those three things are separate and distinct and don't seem superfluous to me at all. Help me with that.
Well, Justice, I believe that the legislature in enacting the second scenario by the employee because of her physical restrictions, that doesn't go to the termination issue. You know, who terminates who is not relevant. It's whether or not the employer doesn't have work available, in which case the legislature intended because of, for instance...
Well, but listen, you sit here and sure. say, the legislature didn't intend this, and it didn't make any difference to the legislature who terminated, and yet I have this language. You're not giving me any legislative history to back up what you're saying. The language says, or if the relationship is terminated by the employee. So I assume that's what the legislature meant. That's a different situation. You're saying, no, that's wrong. What authority do you have to support the legislative intent that you're advancing that appears to be contrary to the words of the statute?
I have no legislative history for it, only the interpretation which is given to it, which has been given to it by the Labor and Industry Review Commission in practice, that if there is a no work available for economic reasons, that's a termination for an employer. If the employee, if there is work available, but the employee cannot perform it because of the unscheduled injuries, then that is, in essence, tantamount to a termination by the employee.
You feel that the court, ourselves, should give great weight deference to the interpretation of LERP? In other words, your opposing counsel indicated, look, we're looking at something of first impression. We're looking at 10244. And basically, there has not been the experience with LERP in that area. Are there cases where they have looked, and you cite a few in your brief, at 144, and you're asking us to rely on that and give great weight deference?
I am, Justice. I think that in many of the cases which are brought up in front of the Supreme Court, recently the Breakbush case and the Hagen case, Court of Appeals and Langhoose, they have all found great weight deference. I do believe that LERC has the expertise in interpreting this section, and they have been charged with the administration of the Workers' Compensation Act. They are very familiar with dealing with multiple injury situations in this context. There are several reported decisions on that. And I think that you should give deference to them in that light. And again, I really believe that if you read LERC's decision, they just considered this a scenario B. They didn't try to interpret A or C. They just believed it did not apply, as do I.
Where can I find all of this history about how LERC interprets the statute?
Well, it's not contained in my brief or appendix, Chief Justice. It was simply a comment on my experience from being a practitioner in the field.
But you know, we can, these workers' comp decisions are published by the administrative agency. They also issue rulings that interpret, at least the last time I looked, I thought they did. May be confused about agencies, but why should I take it on faith that this is the way LERC's been interpreting it? I went and looked at your brief, and I can't remember every single word on every page. I hope that's not offensive.
That is not.
but when I looked at the table of authorities, I don't see any LERC decisions, you know. So now I can't remember, unfortunately, every single word in the LERC opinion, but I'd have to have a history that showed this. I mean, and the history could be in the Wisconsin Supreme Court or Court of Appeals cases, but I don't think you got any case directly on the point you're trying to make. I missed it, but I scanned the brief again and I didn't see it.
Well, I agree with that, Chief Justice. There is no case exactly on point, and I agree that in the memorandum of opinion of LERC, they do say we agree with Ametek's interpretation of the second scenario that the restrictions have to be because of injury. So to that extent, on this particular statute,
it doesn't say, and
no,
this is the way we've been doing this for the last 50 years.
No, it does not. And I think it's clear that their language says that they've never come out with an edit and said, this is the way we're going to interpret it up until then. But I don't believe that takes away from the bigger picture that LIRC has interpreted Section 102.44 and has experience in interpreting these statutes in the context of the rest of the Workers' Compensation Act.
Counsel, after this is over, I can go up to my computer and I can bring up your LIRC's webpage, and my recollection is I can get every single one of their opinions. Now, I haven't done that for a while, but that's my recollection. Are you telling me when I go do that after this oral argument that I'm going to get their opinions interpreting situations where there's an unscheduled injury, a return to work with 85%, then a scheduled injury? And if so, what are the sites to those so that I can get them?
Justice, I don't. The LIRC website only publishes certain select LIRC decisions, not all LIRC decisions. And so, and I don't believe there is a decision on that website that's analogous to this case. So you probably wouldn't find it.
So this truly is a case of first impression. We're looking in why, that's what I think the other justices are asking. We're going to give a great weight deference. Why should we do it when there isn't any case law? There isn't any LIRC experience in this area.
Well, they have experience in the broader, painting with a broader brush, in interpreting Section 102.44 in the context of loss of earning capacity claims is the best that I can say. I would agree with the court and concede that there is no specific case on point, which is why we're here.
On the other hand, one would think this kind of case would arise with some frequency and regularity. And when I look at the Court of Appeals opinion at A8, they seem to say that if there was a termination for both scheduled and unscheduled components, that there would have been an apportionment for the loss of earnings issue. And they cite Van Zandy.
I think that's correct.
And Langhus.
Langhouse is the Court of Appeals decision, and the Labor and Industry Review Commission is consistently required on scheduled and unscheduled situations where you have to apportion them out so that you can keep the dichotomy of the Workers' Compensation Act, which is scheduled versus unscheduled.
But
injuries.
Then that gets back to that if you don't accept Mr. Becker's position on the interpretation of the statute, you got a factual issue of whether this was scheduled or not.
Well, I think what you have is a factual issue, perhaps, although I disagree with Mr. Becker. You have there's an issue, according to Mr. Becker, as to whether or not the termination from employment was due solely because of the restrictions of the wrist, or were they, in effect, also due to the back. I think that the transcript clearly indicates the answer to that question is that it was solely the wrist. But I would admit that if the court finds that there is some sort of a factual dispute as to the basis of that termination, it would have to be remanded.
Both issues, basically, you're not disagreeing entirely with the proposed counsel, but we need a remand back to the commission.
Only on the issue of whether or not there's an improper finding not supported by credible evidence relative to whether or not the restrictions of the back had any effect on the termination or whether it was solely the restriction of the wrist. I do disagree completely on Mr. Becker's interpretation of the statute and that more than one of these scenarios can apply. And I guess I have a little more time. I'd like to maybe address the third section, the 15% scenario three.
Before you do that, let me throw a hypothetical at you. What if Ms. Morales, at the time that her back went out, what if she had terminated her employment at that time? Would she have been entitled to loss of earning capacity?
If she terminated her employment because there were no jobs available within her restrictions, she would be entitled to loss of earning capacity. If she terminated her employment because she said, I'm just not in the mood to work here anymore. In essence, I quit. And the plant had work available within the permanent restrictions from the back, then she would not be entitled to loss of earning capacity. Okay? Briefly...
So then, if that's the case, then how does your position make any sense? Because she's not allowed to terminate her employment. Let's assume she had a 50% back disability. Loss of earning capacity of 50%. She can't terminate because they make another job available to her. Then later on, she can't work at all. How can she not recover for what she could have recovered for before?
I don't understand your question, Justice. If she goes back to work, she continues to keep her job and she's compensated for her permanent disability. If later her condition deteriorates and she has more severe restrictions and no longer can do her job and has to quit then because of the restrictions, then she would be able to get a loss of earning capacity claim. But as long as the employer is able to continue and willing to continue to employ the individual and has work available within those restrictions, then she gets the work. If she decides not to get the work, she's no different than, if she decides to quit her job, she's no different than any other employee who quits their job.
Counsel, I understand that both sides had vocational experts, and both vocational experts said that this woman is 100% permanently, totally disabled for purposes of working. Is that correct?
I believe that is correct, Justice. What they were referring to, however, and which I really don't think is, what they're referring to is a combination of the injuries. She had a 25-pound weightlifting restriction because of her back. She had a 2-pound weightlifting restriction because of her hands. The vocational experts said that, well, if you consider both, she would be permanently and totally disabled, but there was no apportionment there. And
well,
I think
what
it's
didn't
clear
one
that
apportion? One put 60% of the back, as I understand the record.
That's correct. When they apportion out the restrictions of the back as opposed to the wrist, the VOC expert said, in essence, 50. I think mine said 50. Mr. Becker said 60%. If you just hypothetically decided what she could make in the market if she only had the restrictions of the back.
But it seems odd to me. I mean, carpal tunnel syndrome was a serious matter, and she got paid, what was it, 3%? What was that, $1,500 for that? Okay. But it's your position that she's, vocational experts are saying she's permanently, totally disabled. Let's say she were working at a playground as the playground supervisor. What does carpal tunnel have to do with that? Let's say she was doing a myriad of jobs that don't require the kind of flexion and extension of the wrist. Yet both sides, there's no dispute in this record, both sides say she's unemployable, 100%.
Well, I think that goes back to Mendikoff, Justice. What you're saying is, doesn't it seem inequitable that somebody with such a severe vocational disability isn't able to be compensated? And that's the basic scheme that the legislature put into effect and that Mendikoff reinforced, that if you have a scheduled injury, then regardless of the restrictions, you're limited to the...
But Mendikoff has inherent in it, I mean, that's the whole idea, it has inherent in it, scheduled injuries inherently have loss of earning capacity built into it. That's the theory, right?
That's correct.
How can you say that in a 3% at the wrist that has a compensation of $1,500, here it is, go home, that has inherent in it 100% permanent total loss of earning capacity for the rest of your life? I mean,
That's the basic structure of the Workers' Compensation Act. That's the dichotomy between the scheduled and unscheduled injuries. And there are people who think that that's inequitable. And people in the bar debate that all the time. But
the difference we're talking about here is that we have this back injury unscheduled in the fact situation. I mean, that is
true.
One of the things that Judge Merrick raised, an answer to this. He was concerned about a subterfuge. He said, what happens if the person is very, very disabled, back injury, neck injury, just
horrible situation. Employer's self-insured. Employer says, come on back, I'll give you your job. No problem. And then about a year later, the employer terminates. What happens to that person?
That employee would be entitled to bring a loss of earning capacity claim if they were terminated because the employer cannot supply work to him anymore, or perhaps chose not to. For instance, if he was terminated for misconduct, I think that's what the judge was saying. Under the first provision, termination by the employer, I don't think a termination for disciplinary reasons would in and of itself bar a claim for loss of earning capacity. At that point in time, you fall into provision one, and you could bring your claim. There's further protection to the employer by section 102.446G, which says that if you refuse to accept a bona fide job offer, it's tantamount to you returning to work the same wages. So there are, if you lose your job because of misconduct, and LURC finds that that's the analytical equivalent to refusing a bona fide job, then you wouldn't be able to bring it, but if it's not, you could.
Well,
so you could bring
a
lot of
I don't understand that. So in other words, if the employer after a year with this person who's a basket case says, you know, that person just isn't getting along with the fellow employees and just making the work situation horrible. Animosity, bad personality, terminate. Can that person get permanent total disability then?
You can bring a claim for loss of earning capacity.
And maybe when and maybe not. What does it turn on?
Well, it turns on whether or not the employer, the reason for the wage loss is due to the employer or whether it's due to the employee. And if it's due to the employee, is it due to the restrictions? That's the same scenario.
Well, the employee is going to say, no, bad personality causes all sorts of problems on the workforce. And I happen to have, in the last 6 months, I've taken meticulous notes. I've got this documented, you know. Sally and Bill weren't getting along, you know. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. The alternative is a self-insured employer. I can pay $233 per, is it month or week?
It would depend on the rate, but typically week. It could be much more than that.
$233 per week for the rest of this person's life, or I can hire this person back for a month, 6 months, start putting together a good record, and terminate her for cause.
If she's terminated for cause, under subsection 1, I don't believe she's barred from bringing her claim. She at least, on the surface, qualifies under subsection 1 to allow the division to reopen, and then they may consider loss of earning capacity. They are not barred under that circumstance. My time is up. Thank you, Justices.
Well, thank you, Attorney Felton.
Very good. It was a pleasure.
Now, Mr. Becker, 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to comment on a couple things that Mr. Felton brought up. I mean, he's now trying, as I see it, trying to rewrite 6, sub 6B, both 1 and 2. He's now trying to rewrite number 1 to say if the employment relationship is terminated by the employer for any reason not related to the unscheduled injury, and we'll go to sub 2 and say if the employee terminates because of her physical or mental limitations only from the unscheduled injury. You know, he can't have a boil. He's trying to rewrite the whole statute now. He states that number 1 applies if termination is for something outside the employer's control. Well, in this case, in the example you used, if a person developed Parkinson's, that's outside their control, but they're still no longer able to continue working. That should not be a bar to their ability to claim loss of earning capacity. Again, just in looking at the statutes themselves, I don't think the statutes are that unclear. I think they're fairly clear that if the employment relationship is terminated for any reason, the employee gets to recover. Sub 2 is in there so that the employee can't recover if she says, well, my husband's moving out of town, so I have to quit for that reason, or I want to stay home with my children, and she voluntarily quits. That's what sub 2 is meant to prevent. But otherwise, the loss of earning capacity, those damages were sustained at the time of the first injury. Sub 6B just gives a time when she can bring that claim. With respect to Morales' second claim that because of a combination of the injuries, she should be entitled to perm total, again, sub 102.44 sub 3 and 10252, which is 10252 is the schedule. 10244 sub 3 is for partial disability, anything less than firm total for an unscheduled injury. Again, those apply for partial disabilities. Sub 2 allows the department to make a finding in a case of a permanent total disability that a person is permanently totally disabled from a combination of work injuries. And that's the statute allows it. That's what we have here. Absent the authority for the department to make such a finding, again, you have a situation. And I cited in my brief the purposes behind workers' comp, and they've been cited in many cases, is to compensate the injured employee. You have a person who can't work anymore. $233 a week or $230 a week is about $12,000 a year. That's what you, I'm sorry.
Does it make a difference that she can't work anymore? Or let me give you an example, I think, because I'm still trying to understand how all these things fit together. Let's assume we've got this person who has the back injury and therefore can no longer lift 50 pounds, but she can lift 25 pounds. Okay. So they reassign her in the factory to lift 25 pounds. And then she gets this problem with her hands and wrists, and she can no longer lift 25 pounds, but she can lift 10 pounds. But they don't have a 10-pound lifting job.
Okay.
But there are a lot of other 10-pound lifting jobs out there in the marketplace, but not here.
Okay.
Can she recover under this statute?
Then, under that scenario, I think under Mendikoff, under Bandy Zandi, if she's not permanently totally disabled from the total injuries, then you have to apportion. And then, as in this case, a vocational expert would have to say, okay, she's so much, the back injury rent gives her so much of a disability, and she'd be entitled to recover for the permanent partial disability. If, as in this case, it renders her permanently totally disabled, there was a case, Green Bay Soap, at 87 Wisconsin 2nd. I don't have the page. 87 was second, 561. A person had, this case dealt all with unscheduled injuries, but a person had five scheduled injuries, went to a hearing, and on the sixth one, the department found him permanently totally disabled. It was the same employer, but they had switched insurance carriers, and the new insurance carrier said, we shouldn't be liable for the previous injuries. And the court said, well, your injury made that person permanently totally disabled, so you're liable for the whole thing. Again, in a situation like this, you've got the second injury has rendered her totally disabled. If it was anything less than permanent total disability, I agree the schedules would apply to the wrist injury. But when you have a combination rendering a person permanently totally disabled, I think under 10244.
Well, let me put it another way. Let me assume, for purposes of this record, that Ms. Morell is able to do secretarial work because it only doesn't require lifting. She can put it. No lifting whatsoever, and it requires thinking, and etc. If a job like that is available at some other plant, but not at this plant, can she recover from this plant for 100%?
Not 100%. Because in that case, the vocational expert would say she's not 100%, she's something less, and then we would have to apportion.
Her ability to get a job is limited, but she can get some jobs, so we give her a percent.
Correct.
Well, thank you, Attorney Becker. Thank you, Attorney Feldman. And we'll call the next case, which is...